this and chug it is the metal
quality.
Impulse intention that we're talking about. So I want to talk about avijja, which is ignorance. It's the last of the fetters. And all of these things are obstructions to us because they keep us entangled. And I guess the word entangled is really the best. You feel entangled. Ignorance is... The word is avijja. There's another word, moha, which is they talk about greed, hatred, and delusion. That's moha is translated as delusion. They're the same. They're functional equivalents. They're used in slightly different contexts, but they're the same within the teachings. Avijja is the first link in the chain of dependent origination. It's one of the three fires, not the three poisons, by the way. To translate greed, hatred, and delusion as a poison misses the Buddha's initial joke and metaphor. In the Brahmin households at the time, in the temples, there were three fires that needed to be kept burning all the time. There's the fire of creation, and then in your house was the fire that represented the head of the household. They all had to be the third, and they had to be burning all the time. And so they had to be tended and fed constantly. And the word for feeding the fires was upadana. It's the Pali word that is translated as grasping, clinging. So the Buddha was talking about three fires, all good. Three fires, greed, hatred, and delusion, three fires, the eternal flame, So he was talking about three fires, and the second sermon is fire. The ear is a flame, the tongue is a flame. So fire is a metaphor here. And they the tradition lost track of the cultural context, and so they became the three poisons by the time it became Mahayana teaching, and now it just is the poisons or the fires or whatever. And the poisons seem better because we understand poison better than fire in this context. It's just an example of the telephone cable. One of the feathers. It's all over the place. And there's a sense that it's a, for a long time I thought, ignorance, not knowing. It's not knowing something. When we know about, then we can know. We can know about impermanence, but we don't really know deeply. We still think, maybe. Maybe something could be permanent. Maybe that something will be me. You know what I mean? We got that going. It's not a not knowing. It's as active a thing as greed and aversion. Greed, ill will, ignorance. Lobha, dosa, moha. They're all doings. They're all actions. They're all verbs. They're things we do. So it's not just that we don't know, we don't want to know. We don't want to know. Classically, it's understood as not fully understanding the Four Noble Truths and the implications of the truth. Misunderstanding the fundamental nature of reality. Yeah.
So I'm thinking of a TED talk I saw not long ago about something called willful blindness. So you're saying it's like willful blindness. I'm saying, I know about it, but I don't really know.
Well, it's almost not willful. It happens, and I think, again, this is one of these things that I can understand as a product of our evolution. And it's not that it is or isn't. It's a metaphor that helps me place this in the context of the impersonal arising and passing of stuff. You know, if one of our ancestors living out on the savannah looked up and said, "Oh, the universe is so big, I'm so small, what's the meaning of all this? Oh my gosh, and I'm going to die," and this is, you know, while he's out anguishing, he's serving himself up to somebody else. He's not spending his time saying, "How am I going to keep the lions out tonight? Where am I going to find..." "Oh no, this is just really, what a bummer." I see this ignorant stuff as helpful. Keeps us from worrying about it. You can't do anything about it. Which, for me, is a good reason not to worry about it. But still, some people, like Woody Allen, obsesses about it. If you haven't seen Blue Jasmine, Kate Blanchett, something else. But just obsessing about it is maybe not helpful either. But to recognize what it is. So what is it? What is it? Not recognizing the reality of the Noble Truths or the nature of reality. Sort of like right view in a way, seeing, which is seeing the reality, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and emptiness. So I'm gonna do a quick riff on these things, and then we go home after we've disposed of ignorance. The impermanence part is the big. What is it? What is it take to understand Dukkha? It takes, what do you need to understand in order to understand Dukkha? You need to understand Vedana, feeling common, pleasant, unpleasant. You need to understand Tanha. That thirsting for, the need for pleasantness, survival, being, becoming. With that, you can understand sorrow, pain, lamentation, distress, and despair, birth, aging, sickness, death, as dukkha. See them as unpleasant. The other part, and not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, but the other part, that last bit, losing what you cherish. It's a different kind of dukkha. There are three kinds of dukkha that are identified. There's, I love the way they label dukkha dukkha, which is, it's the unsatisfactoriness of unpleasant experience. Being with what you don't want, sorrow, distress, sickness. Being with the unpleasant, which we don't want to be with. Dukkha dukkha. Then there is anicca dukkha, or the paranama dukkha, I believe, it's the dukkha that's rooted in change. You know, if everything is the way you want it, it's all downhill from there. You know, it's what you have and what you cherish is going to change. It's that fourth reflection. All that I am and all that is dear to me is bound to change. There's no way to avoid being separated from it. Oh, so hard. So hard. So painful. It's the dukkha that's rooted in change. The good stuff is gone. Bad stuff's on the way. Or the bad stuff's already here. Unpleasant. And we just resist it. This impermanence business is huge. The Buddha said, you know, just like the elephant's footprint is the biggest footprint in the forest, and you know, all other footprints fall within it. Impermanence. And we know about impermanence. We know about it. It's not a mystery. Nobody's hiding it. But we don't know it as intimately as would be helpful, because, you know, I think the example I gave earlier is I broke my favorite mug. I lost my shirt. My pen's gone. Everything is impermanent. Yeah, I know. I just lost my job. Oh, no. What did I expect? We get older and some of our abilities wane. If you can even remember what they were to rent, you have a benefit to wane. I think they went, but impermanence. It's so obvious, it feels silly to talk about. There is nothing permanent anywhere. From the subatomic flashes of the Higgs boson to the universe, everything is in change. Which means that there isn't a thing anywhere. A thing is a noun. A noun is a part of speech, but there are no things in our experience. If I ask you to imagine an equilateral triangle, was that the same equilateral triangle you imagined the last time? We've all been Platonized. We've got Plato in our cultural genome. The world of forms. There is such a thing as religion. What is religion? And we'll fight over what is religion. Religion is this or that. It's a noun. There are no nouns. And there are some nouns that can experience. There are some nouns which are abstract. The neuro-linguistic programming people talk about it. If you can't put it in a wheelbarrow, it's a abstract noun. So like a screwdriver, into the world. Freedom, justice, an accident. These are abstract nouns, but they aren't things. An accident is a set of occurrences over a period of time. It could be a small period of time. It could be a big period of time. It just wasn't intentional. And we label it with a noun. And then we think, it's a thing. Same with self-view. Self-view is the product of ignorance. Because we think that just because there's a noun, there's a thing there. Does this make any sense? This is very serious. And it underlies not self. It underlies emptiness. The whole notion of emptiness. The concept is not the thing. There is no essence. There is nothing with any essence. No, by essential or selfness. Trying to describe this is tricky. Self, entity. This isn't an entity. It looks like, I don't know, you call it a striker? And I'll hit you. Say it's not a striker. But 100 years ago, a brief flash in universal time. These molecules weren't like this. And it won't be much of a flash later till they're not like this again. This is just a snapshot in this moment. But it's in change. It's empty of any essential nature. Has no nature. Because there's no thing. Does that make sense? This is all there is to this emptiness stuff. It's real easy. There's nothing to grab onto and no one to grab onto it. What is going on? Nouns are parts of speech when we attach to the map. And mistake the map for the territory, we suffer. People will argue. Well, no justice, no peace. No justice. Well, my justice is different from your justice. What's really justice? We're getting the metaphysics here. What's really justice? Well, I can tell you what it means to me, what it means to you, and let's see what we can work out. But We're talking about what's really truth, what's really right, what God really wants. Well, there's only one guy who talks to God. That's the Pope. It's got the red phone. Or maybe it's the white phone. I don't know. I have been in a simulation of the Oval Office. Pretty interesting. It's very cozy. And the acoustics are nice. This was on a reservation where the tribe made lots of money from its casino, and then the guy who was the chief decided that for entertainment purposes he would recreate the Oval Office. And I got to be in there. It was pretty fun. Anyway. This emptiness stuff is treated almost as some mystical thing. And it's treated as mystical because emptiness, the word, is equated with some transcendent ground of being, with Brahman, really, or with what Stephen Batchelor calls God and his surrogates. Yeah, I like the phrase myself. The emptiness out of which all things come and back to which all return. It's just an idea. Emptiness is an idea. It's a concept. And what Nagarjuna pointed out was that emptiness is itself empty. It has no essence. It depends for its understanding on things that are not, on your image of things that are not empty, things that are essential. If you didn't think anything was essential, emptiness wouldn't be a surprise. Everything is just changing. There are no things. The word nouns themselves are impermanent, unsatisfactory, and empty of essence. They are constructions of multiple conditions which result in their appearance as a vector. Where's dukkha? Dukkha is empty. It's the result of unpleasant experience encountering tanha. If you look at the chain of dependent origination, for those of you who are familiar with it, vedana, tanha, dukkha. Nibbana is, when it's treated as a thing that doesn't arise or pass away. Right? It's a thing. It has to always be there. It's described as the deathless. I think, well, that also means it's the birthless. This means it's not there. Nibbana is not a thing. It's conditioned by the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. I'll tell you the unconditioned, said the Buddha. The absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. I'll tell you Nibbana, said Sariputta. It's the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. Delusion. And greed and hatred come out of them. So the root misunderstanding is mistaking the map for the territory, the nouns for the things. There's some essential... What are humans like, essentially? What are we really like? And I see this in Dharma teachings a lot. Our essential goodness. You ever run into that kind of notion? Open to our essential goodness. I don't know about essential goodness. Might be preferable. Like the good part. But hungry people do pretty drastic things. Not pleasant. Not particularly good, in my view. I don't think we're essentially anything. We're streams. We're processes. This, the ignorance, the delusion that there is an entity here leads to action based in greed, wanting more for me. What are the intentions that arise when there is no delusional self occupying our the Brahma Viharas. These are the awakened states. Equanimity with the pleasant and unpleasant, not clinging to the pleasant, not pushing away the unpleasant. Metta, friendliness to other beings. Compassion when the other beings are suffering. And that includes ourselves. It includes each of us, all of us here in this room. And joy when there's pleasant experience. How nice. We need this kind of hard to get sometimes. I had a friend who was blind, and she told a story. She died last year. She told a story about how she was walking with a friend at dusk, and her friend started talking about the sunset and how unbelievable. And she was just the sunset was more than she could have, and she was just going on and on. And Martha said, I couldn't see anything, but I could experience her joy because she was just, mudita, in the joy of others. When we're not acting out of the delusion of permanence, the delusion that something could be satisfying, well, there is no something. So there's nothing to grasp to. Now, some things change slower than other things. So we're left with the delusion that the speed of light is a constant. Nothing is a constant. Conditions change. Maybe even light doesn't exist in some senses. We can try to figure that out. But the delusion seems to me are rooted in the misperceptions, in the vipalasas, in the corruptions of perception, seeing permanence in what is impermanent. If I only got that, then everything would be fine. If I got the better job, the other partner, if I got the if only. Seeing permanence. Essence. I think impermanence, anicca, and anatta, or not self, emptiness, those are both words trying to point at the same thing. Are flip sides of the same thing. Nothing to grasp onto, no one to grasp onto it. What are we doing? You see, the permanence and the impermanence, satisfactoriness, the possibility of satisfactoriness. If I only didn't have to drive this old beat-up thing, then I could drive something that then I'd be happy. That would be okay. That would be so cool. But if you only watch the ads, you can get a new car every year. I get a new Porsche Cayenne every year. In my mind. Oh, look at that. Looks pretty good. Bet it goes pretty quick. And to see beauty in what is not beautiful, to be attracted by what is just the way it is. It's not beautiful, it's not sweet. And the root confusion, if you look at the center of the circle of dependent origination, and by the way, dependent origination is a circle only in graphic form as presented by the Tibetans, but we now think of it as a circle. And going around the circle of dependent origination, but at the center are the pig and the rooster and the snake, and I can't remember which. The snake has got to be ill will, right? The rooster, I don't know. The pig is probably delusion.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And the rooster,
I think he's ill.
Will. Yeah, but it's at the heart of things. So avijja is the last to go. And it's something, and it's intentionally turning away from that realization because it keeps us from getting on with the business of taking care of business. oh yeah, this philosophy stuff is really good, but if I don't get a job in the next week and I got to figure out how to do that, and attention focuses. You know what I mean? It's not just that we don't know. We sort of know about anicca, dukkha, anatta. We, and particularly those of us who've been in Dharma seeds, we know about it. The difference between knowing about it and knowing it. So we use the knowing about it to point to our experience, to get to know it really well. You get to know unsatisfactoriness really well. But part of the unsatisfactoriness is knowing that we, is recognizing and knowing that we add to it. That the dukkha is stuff that we add in. And if we don't add in stuff, there's plenty more joy out there and pleasant experience. I remember building a fire once. Man makes fire. Built the fire in the fireplace and it starts going, and it was a really good one. And my wife was off at the store and it's going really good. You know, you build a fire and it gets really good right away, and then it sort of settles down, and then it sort of gets, and then you throw stuff on and hope for the best. And I thought, this is really, man makes fire, you know. And I was hoping that she would get home in time to see it. And while I was sitting there, hoping that she would get, I was not enjoying the fire. It was beautiful, but I was just, oh, is she getting home? Should I call? See, man makes fire. You can ruin a good experience. And I think probably we've all done that at one time or another. But when we can see that we add that in, there's more by abandoning that addition, by letting go and not taking it up. The delusion to think that there's something wrong with the way things are. It's a projection of dukkha. You just project it out in the world. The world is the way it is. It doesn't satisfy us, we got to complain. Great marker for dukkha. So it's just the way it is. Whether we like it or not, including our not liking it. And not liking it comes with the territory too. So it's the last of the fetters. Is classically not seeing the three characteristics. And not seeing the way our clinging works. The way our wanting, our longing, the way tanha shows up, yeah.
Is it not seeing, or is it not accepting that you still can't get a better deal? You still can't dip your toe in and have the best path? Because everybody's fairly familiar with emptiness and impermanence.
You think?
To an intellectual extent.
Intellectually. Although emptiness is pretty confusing. People don't get that.
So the question is, if we know about impermanence, and we're still ignorant, then we either haven't accepted it or haven't seen it deeply enough to...
Well, it isn't something to accept. The notion of accepting is something different than the notion of seeing. Accepting means I got this proposition, like it or not, I got to take it as real. Seeing is ignoring what the prescription is, ignoring what the proposition is, just seeing directly. It's not accepting. It's just recognizing what's present. It's not... Accepting suggests to me that despite... I have to acknowledge, or, you know, you have to accept the teachings as they are. Accept Christ as your Savior and you'll be fine. That's how acceptance comes to me in this context. Whereas seeing clearly, just seeing that if I hold on, I'm going to be disappointed in the end because my new car will become old. My relationship is going to change. My granddaughter will become a teenager, and oh my God, like Justin Bieber.
I think that, you know, that idea of accepting sometimes can have that little bit of reluctance of,
yeah,
I really don't want that to be, but I have to.
And there's a moralism. There's a moralism there. I should accept it. I should accept things the way things are. And that should is an idea about how things should be. And then, of course, if I don't, well, then there's judgment because I'm not. Because I still get upset when, you know, I realize this body's getting old and doesn't do the long jump like it used to do the long jump. It's the sort of the short jump. If jump is even the appropriate verb. You go farther falling forward on my face. And that may be true. So it's the acceptance suggests a should. There's a should.
Right. Or there's some kind of quality of wanting it to be different.
And there's, yeah.
Because it's not. Because there's some...
It's not needing it to be different.
Something has to happen.
Not needing it to be different. And it's putting tanha to rest in the sense that if we just don't take the bait enough times, pretty soon we won't even see it as bait. Emptiness, I don't think people get emptiness generally. They think of it as a thing, as something. And Nagarjuna, who wrote the treatise that really laid it out in most detail. Nagarjuna is someone to look at, by the way. He's considered the number two thinker next to the Buddha in the tradition generally. He said if you are attached, people can become attached to the notion of emptiness. And then you're stuck, because emptiness is not a thing. It's a way of seeing. Where you just see the transience, the insubstantiality of experience.
Transience sounds better.
Transience?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You hold that up and explain the transience of that.
Yeah.
And then it shows it as empty, but transience gives it a little bit more understanding for my mind.
Uh-huh. It's not, and the concept is just a concept. There's in the tradition, there's the discussion of the two truths, the relative truth and the ultimate truth. And often that gets distorted as there's conventional reality and ultimate reality. And we're already off into Vedanta land. Ultimate reality, Brahman, God and his surrogates, St. Teresa of Avila says, everything's passing, nothing affright thee, everything has changed. God only prevails. God only survives. Emptiness is what is there when everything's gone. And it's built in, the two truths. Conventional truth is what we talk about when we're using language conventionally. Ultimate truth, well, the ultimate truth is that there is no ultimate truth. Or you could say the ultimate truth is conventional truth is empty. And it's being able to engage the experience in the moment. If it isn't changing fast enough for you out here, it's certainly changing fast enough for you in here. Robert Rauschenberg, who was a painter, I think he died last year, but maybe the year before, very recently, so it's 20th century mostly. He said, you can't look at my paintings twice. And that's sort of like Democritus saying you can't step in the same river twice. But not quite. It's not that the molecules in the painting have changed, so it's a little different. It's when you've seen the painting once, next time you see it, you've already seen it. You're not the same person. It's not the same experience. You can't look at my paintings twice. Because the internal change is so quick. And it is so quick. What were you thinking? What was in your mind when you came in from lunch? Gone, back there with the dinosaurs, you know, evaporated. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, we here who know that we will die, quarrels always cease. So the illusions lead us to actions that are that make things worse. Wanting things to be differently. So these are the 10 fetters that tie us to existence. Now, in the Abhidharma, I'm just going to go through them, and we've talked about them. There are different lists: sensuous craving, ill will, conceit, wrong views. We talked about those. Skeptical doubt, clinging to mere rules and rituals, rites and rituals. Rites and rituals are habits. Habits. Personal rite, personal ritual, but they can be cultural too. Craving for existence, that's bhava tanha. Envy, which is the opposite of, that's when you hear that somebody else got that Porsche. You know. Envy. The first thought is, oh, I'd like that. And not, oh, how wonderful. It's a reflex. Nothing wrong with it. It's just that it's unpleasant. And when we act out on it, it makes things worse. Stinginess, the opposite of generosity. And ignorance. So they're all basically hovering around the same, it came to my mind, the same garbage dump. It's like seagulls circling the ballpark at the end of the game. You know, at Pac Bell Park, about the eighth inning, the birds come out, they know everybody's leaving, and they're just out in center field. They're just up there. And if the game goes to extra innings, they get real cranky. That's just the image of all these things are circling the same, and really delusion is at the heart. Delusion of making and mistaking the map for the territory. Wanting our experience pleasant. It's not real complex.
I mean, do you want to say a little bit about maybe the difference between wrong view and ignorance? Because there.
Wrong view would be both a formulation. That goes along the line, for example, that goes along the lines, if I could get my car fixed, then I'd be happy. If only I could be happy. Wrong view is the idea that you'll make yourself happy by achieving your dreams. That's out there in the culture. It's big. You'll hear that. You can realize your dreams.
That's based on that fundamental thing of ignorance.
It is based on ignorance. But ignorance is you could say that they're wrong view is a specific manifestation of a formulation that is going to lead to dukkha, and you think it's going to lead to joy. And so we hope we can learn from experience. So let me take a couple of minutes and see what you guys think of the fetters and today and stuff like that. I think I might be comfortable ending. I know everybody on these day longs, everybody starts wilting earlier than they hoped. You know what I mean? So let me just see if are you guys all free of the fetters?
want to absorb.
Going federalist? Go forth federalist, yeah. It's a lot. It's a lot to work with. It's a lot to work with. Anything still catching your craw? Not that you have a craw.
It was really good. It was really good. Mm-hmm. A lot to think. I have a couple more that I got to work on, though. But I'm getting there.
Just a couple. Well, it's,
yeah,
you know,
just a couple.
It was as you know, as the ocean slants and inclines, so will our practice incline us toward nirvana, particularly if we have an understanding that's helpful. If we have an understanding, I know that I went into there's a Buddhist bookstore in Van Ness in San Francisco. It's a Chinese bookstore, and I went in. I can't remember what. I think I was looking for a bell. And the woman behind the counter started talking about how, well, I'm glad to see you, so we can work for a better rebirth. I thought, well, you know, if you're thinking that your task is to follow the precepts so you get reborn in a better, with a better vantage point at attaining nirvana.
Attachment.
I'm sorry?
Attachment.
Well, you know, it's we're living in that map. We're living on that map that's on the thing that's... And the map is drawn with nirvana off there in a cloud somewhere. We want to live forever. We don't like this impermanence business. So we'll fantasize heaven and hell. Heaven, hopefully. Or multiple births. And we won't be reborn as a cockroach in the South American cave. <You know? laughs> Well, that's all potential when once you get into these fantasies. You know, what can you imagine?
I have a question.
Please.
The craving for immaterial existence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what that means. Me, what it would seem to be when you are experiencing some true, your own perception of true appreciation, love, awareness, beauty.
Immaterial existence, in this case, actually. What happens is, in the tradition anyway, there's an association of various jhana states with heaven realms. So, you know, and so immaterial existence is rebirth in. If we're here because, this is the theory, because we want to be, craving, desire. Remember, if you take dukkha as the first truth and you say birth is dukkha, and the cause, and you interpret the cause of dukkha, which is the second truth, is tanha. And you say, birth is caused by desire. What does that mean? Oh, I've been reincarnated because I wanted to. And that's out there. Okay. The fine material realms, these are the exquisite, pleasureful realms of jhana, and they correlate with some heavenly abode, some place to be. So the fine material are the four lower jhanas, the what do they call it, the immaterial existence, the four higher jhanas. But the trick is that it's just craving for more pleasant experience. That's what we want. We want things pleasant. So the craving for fine material or immaterial is just more wanting. If you ever find yourself wanting transcendence, wanting transcendence is the flame. We want to see our own compulsion to act. Is that helpful?
Yeah. We have to see it in a different way.
For a lot of us, experience of the realm of neither perception nor not non-perception, probably not on our dance card. But that's okay for me.
Yeah, another way to maybe say that would be that we can get attached to experiences, meditative experiences, states of mind.
Yeah.
Pleasant states. Whether they're warm or
we like less. Those good sittings.
You know, it feels good. And then we do everything we can. In fact, you know, Steve Armstrong has a wonderful saying. He says, you know, all it takes is one good sitting to ruin your day. Right? Because what you do is you experience something very pleasant, and then you struggle to get that back because that becomes the standard, or that becomes the goal. Instead of forgetting that the goal is freedom, we go, that was so good, that must be it, I've got to go after that. And so you do everything you can, you do all the rites and rituals of, oh, I was sitting this way, and I was breathing in this way, and we try to recreate a situation that can't be recreated. And we suffer tremendously.
That's the guy, for some reason I think it was Wittgenstein, but one of those guys went to see Don Giovanni and had such a great time. He went back the next night to the same experience, went to the same restaurant, ordered the same, went to the same, got the same seats, and you know, not the same. That pleasant experience is wonderful. Nothing wrong with it. But then wanting it again is to lose track of what's present. And adds our displeasure with what's present to what's present. So if what's present is unpleasant, we add our own disappointment, which is an increment of unpleasantness. So how do we make things better? By at least taking that off the table. And if you take that off the table, things are immediately better. Maybe not all better. All better.
It's just how it is.
Yeah. Anything else about these guys? Well, it's just a pleasure to get to talk Dharma for a day, so I am very pleased to have a chance to come and see you guys and talk about the fetters. Mm-hmm. And it was Lori's idea to talk about the fetters, and I'm really, really pleased to have a chance to do that.
Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you guys.
Thank you very much.
I see. Don't they say something in the Catholic Church like "Go forth and cling no more"? Something like that.
But then that could change.
Sin no more.
Oh. I knew it was something.
Cling a word.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.
So, there's a couple of tasks that we'd like to, we're going to be taking care of right here. So, again, if you'd like the opportunity to practice generosity with us, there's like maybe two or three people to help out afterwards. We have the little sheets. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
And you've been one. I want to save some for anybody else who might want one. Just around if you were interested.
Oh, that's good.
See, this day's a good day.